Welcome, Patreons, to part two of episode 11, The Communism of Love with Richard Gilman Opalski. I'm really grateful for your support, and I hope this project brings some joy and hope and utility to your works and days. And I'll just reiterate that, you know, my plan is to review and maybe reflect a little bit beforehand in these second parts on the first parts, and then I'll roll the rest of the interview, but also return with some further reflection. So that's what I'll do today. So in part one of this two-part episodes, poli-sci prof and improv jazz drummer Richard Gilman Opalski answered my first question leading off about why the heck I didn't have a definition of love before reading his book. And he did this by talking about how many vital concepts such as freedom, democracy, you know, even when we hear the word America said with somebody who obviously is imagining a capital A, these terms can often be used unconsciously, uncritically, in a way in which they take on a given meaning that is established by underlying force and interests that we can't really see, that actually conceal themselves. And I said, oh, that reminds me of what Jacques Derrida says about the transcendental signifier. And he said, oh yeah, I took classes with that guy. So that was cool. Now, Richard's Communism of Love insists that love is an active, non-transactional relation that contradicts the logic of capitalism. You can't measure it, you can't spreadsheet it, you can't cost it out. And unfortunately, this fact can also curdle into an excuse for sidelining and ignoring the vast amount of unpaid, often gendered domestic labor, the secret workshop described by feminist Marxists, where the concept of love can be abused and weaponized to justify the demand to work for free and to claim that, you know, love is your payment, love should be your reward. And we also talked about how real family love requires parents to actively participate in their children's becoming who they are not yet, without attempting to control or ossify them. And this means getting over some kind of anxiety of controlling outcomes and the tendency to treat children as emotional or even financial investments. Parenting, like revolutionary politics and improv jazz, requires a constant collective improvisation and a love for possibilities, instead of, you know, a kind of fixation on rigid or predetermined structures. So we'll pick up the interview with me reflecting on what it was like to not learn piano through improvisation. It's quite melancholic, actually, to hear you describe the fact that, yes, when I sat down at the piano to begin with, and I'm 5 years old, I was just playing and listening and, you know, sort of in sort of a conversation with the instrument. And that very quickly, not because, you know, this wasn't the fault of my parents. They didn't have musical education themselves. And so they just sent me to a place where I was going to get some. And that sort of freedom was really drummed out of me almost instantly into exercises and scales and note reading and trying to replicate something rather than trying to express something. And I remember that, well, I think now what happened was that that experience of suppression actually made me yearn for improvisation, freedom elsewhere. And I found that, I did find that in writing, thank goodness, later. But it took a while. So, but back to, yes, fascists hated jazz. And they certainly hated improvisational jazz. And I think they also really hated the notion that parents should be somewhat humble about what they know and what they don't know, and their expectations for their children really shouldn't be oppressive. So is that all fair? Is that part of what the fascists brought to this conversation of development?
Robert Chapman has written a little bit about as well the Nazi and fascist history of dealing with what we today call neurodiversity.
Right.
Right. And this effort to kind of, we were talking before about maps, developmental maps, the given maps that help us figure out where we are. Those exist not just for childhood development, but they exist for music. They exist for the financial sector, for investment. And it is absolutely a part of fascism, which we can get to that maybe more, I think, in a more basic or philosophical sense, maybe in a moment, having to do with the question of control, right? Total control, maximal control, maximizing control, maximizing predictability, scientizing becoming. You know, these are all things which are irreducibly in tension with improvisation, transformation, becoming, creating something new and unpredictable, right? And so this latter series of ideas, the unpredictability, the openness, the creativity, the improvisation, the experimentation, these are necessary in parenting. They're also necessary in any kind of radical politics, or if we were going to think about a revolutionary horizon of any kind at all, we need those orientations. And they're quite clearly opposite to the orientations of fascists. So absolutely, I would say.
There's something extraordinarily contradictory about fascist modes of control, because when we go and look at the actual behaviors of, you know, those leaders and demographics, often they are in states of absolute personal and emotional chaos, right? Like, on one hand, there's the drive to make sure that the children are all wearing the right lederhosen and they're singing the right songs. And on the other side, there is, you know, the vision of the Wehrmacht all on meth and off their heads as they hurtle into mechanized warfare. And so there's this very difficult way in which, control over creativity also seems to come out sideways, or be off-gassed in this kind of aggression.
In certain circles, Matthew, certain conferences, academic conferences and political circles, one of the more controversial positions I take as a Marxist, as an open Marxist, is humanism, that Marxist humanism, which I think is more important than ever, is to talk about human becoming, human flourishing. The humanism is there in my book, The Communism of Love, but I've been dealing with these questions as a humanist for a long time. And I think what you're pointing out with the Wehrmacht and the sort of the illusion of total control, but the impulse against it, is very important, because I would say that fascism is fundamentally anti-human, right? I mean, human flourishing, human becoming, it cannot be so tightly bound as the fascis.
Yeah.
You know, the fascis of fascism, I think maybe that is that is a crucial point, is that if you look at if our listeners were to look up what a picture of a fascis, you know, F-A-S-C-E-S, it's a tightly bound bundle of rods, a strange implement with an axe head protruding out of the other side. And before fascism became a political concept in Italy, there was the fascis that was inspired. It was inspired, Mussolini and the fascist party in Italy was inspired by this idea of strength through tightly bound, you know, almost no wiggle room, no openness. The strength of the fascists comes from maximal control, minimal dissent, no wiggle room. A fascist where the rods are not so tightly held together is a weak weapon.
Right.
So the strength comes from this tightly bound absence of wiggle room. I would point out here, though, as well, and I think this is very important and almost always neglected when people on the left talk about fascism, I think it's a big problem, is that moving from the fascists to fascism in Italy, it was expressly anti-communist.
Right.
I mean, that is a crucial point. And
yeah.
Max Horkheimer wrote a great essay called The Jews in Europe in the early 1930s, in which he said, those who speak of fascism who are unwilling to speak of capitalism should keep their mouths shut.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So it's really connected. It's anti-human and it's anti-communist. And for me, this is extremely important because human beings and the abolition of the existing reality, as Marx defined communism, requires an openness. It requires possibility. And, you know, I think that if we talk about anti-fascist parenting, which I think is part of our reason for talking today, anti-fascist parenting has to be less like a fascist. It has to be more open. There has to be more wiggle room. And I think in that doing that, it's more human and also in a sense, more communistic, right? I mean, in the original sense of communism, the Gemeinwesen that we aspire to, the sense of human solidarity and community that we aspire to, it requires a certain flexibility that is not present in the fascist orientation.
It's not present. And also it seems to contain betray its own destruction constantly because it doesn't work for the sticks to be bound so tightly. If we're talking about human beings, it doesn't work. It will not work. And I think that, you know, the contradictions that I'm pointing to with regard to Wehrmacht soldiers are one thing, but I mean, we also currently have fascist, you know, implementation of policy throughout the United States, headed up by people who are obviously out of control. People who are, you know, emotionally, cognitively, in terms of substance use, in terms of their interpersonal relationships, are all over the map. There's the paradox is almost, it's like a, I don't want to say that it's a comedy, but there's something absurd about it, that we have an entire cabinet that is made up of, you know, people who are either felons or sex assaulters or, obvious substance abusers on the job, and they're trying to control everybody else. There's something absolutely bizarre and yet very predictable about that.
So I agree with this, and I think this gets to the point about the anti-humanism of fascism. The anti-humanism of fascism is that human agents of fascism, even they, are out of control. And for them, it's maybe some combination of false projection and aspiration, right? Is that they want the control they lack.
Yeah.
It's sort of like when I'm feeling really out of control in my life, I open up a calendar and start planning things, right? Clean my office. It's these two impulses, you know, maybe go together. But the thing is, and with regard to the U.S., just for a moment on that, if I may, is, you know, the first Trump presidency in the United States, when Trump gave his nomination acceptance speech, it was famously called the Law and Order speech. And it was a reaction against Black Lives Matter. It was a reaction against the uprising. The George Floyd rebellion had not happened, but we'd seen Baltimore in the wake of the killing of Freddie Gray and Ferguson, very close to where I sit, Minnesota. There were a number of different movements that were happening, and Trump wanted to control that. Now, if you fast forward to the present, we are talking together in August of 2025. What Trump is trying to do is take cities and crack down on any kind of dissent. I mean, part of this is because there were some very powerful uprisings against ICE in California.
Right.
But another part of this is just the craving for control. Your point is that I think underneath this facade, the facade of the fascists for control, is a certain out of control, chaotic, wildness going on behind the scenes, or sometimes not behind the scenes. Sometimes it's right there before your eyes. But, and I agree with that, but I think what is much more important is the ways that we get out of control, because we can never count on the wild side of fascists. That will not manifest in our favor. You're right, I think, you know, from the point of view of the relationship of fascism to human beings, but politically, the real question is, how will we get out of control in the face of being so tightly bound? These crackdowns, right, of the fascistic leaders now in power, we don't know when, but there is always what I've talked about in a different book of mine, the specter of revolt. And this is an idea that I actually got originally from reading Jacques Derrida's book, Specters of Marx. But that, you know, this, there will be reactions against this tightly bound fascistic tendency. And the ones that don't come from the agents of fascism are the ones we have to hang our hopes on. And I do think there is always cause for hope.
I think we've established that love is anti-capitalist. And I just wonder if you have an overview view of what happens to families and to our vision of the family when we don't have that understanding. What is at stake?
Part of what I want to say, Matthew, is that, you know, if we don't have this vision of the family, it's particularly catastrophic in this form of society. But you could imagine that the family could even perhaps be abolished if we had a society that secured for children, for vulnerable people, what is now outsourced to families as their private responsibility.
Right.
You know, now inside of a decent family where there's a lot of real care and reliable support, love, you can find some true believers in capitalism who are pretty good dads and pretty good moms. You can find some parents who don't have, who don't share my vision or my theory of love, or the communism of love, who are good parents, and there's decent, healthy, and loving families there. But what I would say in that case is that there is a communism at work inside of that family, even if the members of the family are, you know, full-throated anti-communists. It's hard for a lot of people in capitalist society to realize that the best things under capitalism are the least capitalist things. Right? The best things in a capitalist society are the least capitalist things. So they may not be interested in my theory. They may not be interested in reading Marx or the concept of communism of love. But part of my aim with my work is to make these non-capitalist forms of life, which we value more than any other of our relationships in the world, which are more important to us than anything else we experience in life, to make that visible. Right? So I want to help people see that even in a capitalist society, there are experiences and relationships, the ones that mean the most to us are the least capitalist. If we could have a conversation about that, if we could talk about what it means to experience love in a capitalist world, the kind of refuge it creates for people from work, right? During a crisis like COVID, if we could talk about these refuges that we create for each other, not that we pay for, not that we buy them, not that they come to us with a bill later on, but we create them voluntarily out of the activity of love. If we could see that those things we value the most have no exchange value, the things we value the most have no exchange value from a capitalist point of view, what else could we see?
I think that you're describing the possibility that this threshold between the home and the larger society could somehow become, I don't know, softer or more permeable, and that the, you know, avowed capitalist dad who is actually a really decent person and who really loves his family is somehow able to bring that to a larger sphere, is somehow able to say, oh, the way in which things work in my household don't actually follow the rules of, you know, exchange value. They don't actually, I'm not keeping accounts. Why do I put on my suit and tie and pick up my briefcase and enter into a completely different world? Like, am I split? Am I two different people? I think that's what you're pointing to. And I think that's really hard. Yeah. I think it's really hard. And I think also that there's also a barrier that I have recently kind of sussed out in some of the more liberal self-help, let's help our boys especially do better in this world kind of discourse that's emerging. And it kind of looks like this. It is... you know, I know this is the capitalist dad speaking to the son who he loves and they get along really well and he's very supportive. I know that things are tough out there, but this is what you have to do. This is how you can get ahead. And I have faith in you and I know that you can do it and I will help you as much as I can. And there will be this sort of sphere in which basically, a communist promise can be offered, but without the sort of expectation or the possibility that it could be extended beyond and out into the world, where, you know, the dad isn't saying, well, you know what? The situation that we live in sucks and we should both change it together. It's more like the world is as it is, and I will be your support and your source of love to the extent that I can help you tolerate it. And that's where it ends, right? That's kind of like the ultimate value proposition of that kind of parenting. And I just don't think it's good enough. I don't think it, I know why it's attractive. It almost has like a mournful, almost existential mood to it. Like, I know, son, I know this is really hard, but you know, you can do it. And if you can't, then well, I guess I'll still love you anyway, right? But it's not about changing things.
I agree with you, but we have to be careful when we, and I do agree with you, Matthew, but when we say it's not good enough, we have to be careful not to convert that into a greater responsibility for the parent.
Oh, for the parent themselves, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The parent is also placed in, also inhabits this upside down world of cruelty and neuroses and insecurity,
yeah,
psychological and financial. And we're all living in that world. And I think that part of what I would want to say about the decent capitalist parent is if they could see that the orientation they take toward their beloveds is the right orientation, and then think about what it would mean to deprivatize that orientation,
yeah,
and to turn it across the border into Gaza, or to turn it outside at the borders towards immigrants. Or to turn it, or what would that mean in terms of our orientations about healthcare and education, psychology, ecology, right? And so something about the deprivatization of that orientation. Now, the limits of the capitalist dad, who may be a good-hearted, liberal, kind, generous to his son or daughter, right? The limits is that The limit is that they will see no reason to deprivatize that orientation because it seems to them perfectly appropriate as the private property of their own family. And that's where I disagree. I think if it's appropriate there, it must also be appropriate elsewhere.
Right.
You know, and you had asked a question. I somewhat eluded that point, and I didn't do it on purpose, but now I'm remembering is what happens to the child where this isn't the case. And I sort of glossed over that. But, you know, there is a lot of very good research in both critical theory and psychoanalytic theory that talks about the importance for children who are becoming of affirmation, of being attended to in their frailties, of being seen. There's a great book by the critical theorist Axel Honneth, The I in We, in which he talks about children who lack this necessary kind of affirmation and what it means for them. It's not just true for children in their immediate families, these little privatized islands of care. It's true for children everywhere. And, you know, inside of families, people can be expelled without this. They can be disowned if they're transgender. They can be disowned if they're queer. They can lose their families if they take a particular view politically, right? I mean, so there are some really concrete consequences. The other side of that, and just be very brief on this point, is Bell Hooks, the late Bell Hooks, she wrote quite a few books on love as a political concept. So I did mention Eric Fromm, but I always want to mention Bell Hooks too when I do that, because she is unfortunately sometimes not given the seriousness she deserves for her attention to love as a social and a political power. But Hooks was very good at warning against thinking about the family as the site of love, you know, that many people aren't going to have that.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to flee the family at some point in search of active love relations outside of it.
Yeah.
So two points about that. One point is that we should never assume that the family is the place of love, because for too many people, it simply isn't. And the second point is we better learn how to deprivatize love, because a lot of people who flee the family in search of it need to find it.
Last question, Richard. Let's say that you leave the university for a year to teach high school or maybe even middle school. How would you smuggle these ideas into whatever you were teaching? I'm assuming that you're not going to be given a grade 7 philosophy class, but it might be history, might be some sort of, you know, social studies class. What would you turn to?
You know, it's another difficult question, because teachers in high schools and middle schools and elementary schools are given a curricular program that they have to reproduce, and they are also measured on a spreadsheet of sorts, just like their kids are. And so some of the tests at the schools, the public schools my kids have gone to, my own kids have said, well, I'm not being tested. The school is being tested. But one thing any teacher can do, and this is not just in high school or middle school, but this is anyone who teaches anywhere, is they can conceive of their role as participating in the becoming of their students, that you are, you know, you're not determining it, as we've discussed. You don't have that much control. You're not a fascist, after all, hopefully. But you can aspire to the great honor and privilege of participating in their becoming. One thing you in your question, Matthew, that I think is really key is when you said smuggle it in. How could you smuggle it in? And I love that phrasing, because it points to the problem that it would have to be smuggled in at all. I mean, what concept of education would require this approach to the becoming and human flourishing? In what concept of education would that have to be smuggled in? You know, and so some kind of an act, you could activate perhaps what we might call a pedagogy of love, right? Bell Hooks, who wrote a lot about love, also wrote a book about education called Teaching to Transgress. And actually, she wrote several of them. So there are people who are thinking about smuggling it in. There's a rigid curriculum, perhaps, but one thing you can do is you can introduce perspectives beyond it. You can do damage control on the ideological limitations of the program. If you're a history teacher who is supposed to teach the 20th century a certain way, then maybe you have to do that to keep your job, but you can also move beyond it to introduce challenging perspectives. The tragedy of the situation, though, is that if you go too far, you can be fired for it. And that, I think, is all on its own an indictment of education such as it is, that the best ideas would have to be smuggled in, that the orientations kids need would have to be smuggled in, really means that we need a different system.
Richard, thank you so much for your time today. It's a real pleasure to speak with you. I really appreciate your work.
Thank you so much, Matthew. It's been an honor and a pleasure to talk.
Since we're around that time of year, I've been thinking about the communism of Christmas, or maybe how Marx would regard the materials of the seasons, the sensuous details that make the holiday feel as it feels. And so I've been thinking about that, and I've got a reflection on that for you. And I think it will loop back into the communism of love. I think we can all feel it start in early December, especially if we're here on Turtle Island. The colors of the retail world change, and the memories start flowing. What is all the familiar warmth? What are all these radiant objects that are somehow connected to birth and love and salvation? The evergreen tree, the ornaments, the music and candles, wrapping paper, holly, shortbread, ribbons. How do these things come to us? How do they appear to us? And why do they seem to communicate something vast, something eternal? My late mother was so industrious with handicrafts and decorating and baking. Some of my earliest Christmas memories involve unpacking and hanging the ornaments she made by hand in the 1970s. She would cover styrofoam balls with pleated scraps of satin left over from making a blouse or a skirt. She made all her own clothes. And she would use pushpins with glass bead heads to sort of fix the satin in and also create designs and patterns. We made popcorn strings with dried cranberries every foot. And we tried to store them carefully from year to year. And that was hard. They would crumble, of course, and then we'd have to redo it. My mother also made Christmas fruit cake from an old European recipe. She would soak the dried fruit in brandy for days, and then after baking it all into this dense brown loaf, she would wrap the slices of it in brandy-soaked cheesecloth and store them in vintage cake and cookie tins. She also found this old German recipe for an anise-flavored butter cookie called Springerli, and she took great pride when they bulged up in the oven, like springing up. That's what the name is about, Springerli. Now, my dad's family was German Catholic, and the tradition or habit was that we would open gifts late at night after midnight mass. And in the dead of night, the tree was just blazing, and it looked like it had always been there. And it felt like it connected me directly to a shed in Palestine. And then there were also these plays, there were pieces of music, there were movies that contributed to this feeling of continuity, of eternal return, if only because they repeated from year to year. I'm not sure when I started to see through the glow to understand the ephemeral nature of the commodities that made it up. I think it came in small moments. At one point, I realized that the Grinch was a modern story, only decades old. When I started getting into
vintage films, I realized after a while that, you know, The Miracle on 34th Street wasn't made that long ago, actually. And then the Peanuts special, the Christmas special, it dropped in the 1970s. But it had seemed to have always been there. Now, today, I'm the dad in charge of the tree lights. And, you know, if one string in the old box doesn't light up anymore and the replacement bulbs aren't working for it, and I go to try to replace it, but none of the new lights are incandescent, they're all LED, I find myself saying, you know, I prefer the traditional lights. And suddenly that is ridiculous. Like, what the hell am I saying? There's nothing about those lights that were traditional. Those lights that I loved were the expression of exactly what labor could produce at that time. A particular type of green, rubber-coated, twisted wire and little replaceable bulbs with bright gold filaments, and they represented a unique and temporary intersection of resources, labor, and consumer demand. There is a tradition, but it's not of things. It's of making things to which meanings become attached. Now, my mom's industry and aesthetics were so well honed that this distinction kind of remained hidden from me for a long time, maybe longer than it otherwise would have. You know, she told me that the fruitcake recipe went back centuries, and that the brandy, of course, was ancient, and that was true. She told me that the Springerly cookies went back to the medieval period. And the fact that she was reconstructing these commodities from international supply chains and baking them in an oven made possible by industrialism, this disappeared behind the joy and the enthusiasm of feeling something to be authentic. Now, occasionally, the reality of capitalism attempted to shine through the glare. I remember the moment in the 1951 Christmas Carol film where the guy who's playing Bob Cratchit arrives in the frigid office, and Scrooge is not going to allow him to burn any coal on Christmas Eve in the little stove in the office. And I don't know why that stood out. Why that made such a stark impression on me amongst all of the other possible moments. I mean, I guess I identified with Bob sitting on his clerk's stool, shivering in his threadbare coat, rubbing his hands so they'd be warm enough for him to write with his ragged quill pen. I also remember Depression-era stories about the pleasure of getting a Florida orange for Christmas morning. As the main present, like that was enough for the child. And like all Depression stories, it seemed to have been told for the grim joy of having survived it. But it also made it sound like that period of terrible deprivation and poverty was kind of like a natural disaster. I've known many, many boomers, and I've never heard a single one of them say, hey, my father, my mother never forgave the capitalists for causing the Depression. Why didn't I hear anybody say that? Why didn't that come down to me? Why did a disaster like that get lumped into the kind of like unavoidable things we survived category? Now, in my own time, I sometimes went to help an eccentric Catholic doctor here in Toronto named Andrew Simone down on the shipping docks. What he would do is he would collect food aid from local businesses and he would pack it into shipping containers, also donated. And the shipping containers were bound for Ethiopia. This was the 1980s. And so that's where a lot of news about, you know, global inequality and food crises was coming from. Now, I was proud to be 11 or 12 years old and carrying 50-pound bags of rice on my shoulder. But when I stopped to think about why so much food was needed so far away and why that was, I was very troubled by that. There was another moment in which capitalism, and I guess in this case,
colonialism seemed to sort of interject itself into this set of Christmassy feelings. And this was that, you know, later on in retirement, my parents visited Israel. And one of their stops one time was in Bethlehem, where at that time, at least, there was still a robust handicraft industry serving Christian pilgrims. The carvers would turn olive wood from their family olive groves into crosses, Bible scenes, and creche figures. Now, my mother just loved artisans in general, and specifically, I think, the idea of like networks of handiworkers, like wherever she found a community of people who were just making things together, she just really loved that. And I think she might have fantasized of that being her entire life in community with makers of things. So she found a woodworker in the market who was selling a full set of figures. And they were packed into a stable made from thinly split planks of olive wood, and she bought it. And that was decades ago, and now it's in our home. And I look at it, and I remember how it used to fill me with reverence because it came from the Holy Land. It was carved by hands that knew the soil where all of this had happened. But now I see through that to understand that the wood carving industry itself only professionalized in Palestine after steam travel made it a tourist destination in the 1850s. When I thought about how the woodworker with whom my mom felt common cause was at the end of a long line of artisans who were now losing their access to markets and olive wood because the IDF is uprooting grove after grove in their ethnic cleansing endgame. And so these olive wood icons that carry such feelings of depth and continuity had emerged from colonial contact and were now disappearing through ethnic cleansing. The things that seem to carry that sense of eternity never do. But something does. What is it? Now, that original creche wasn't a series of objects, by the way. It began when St. Francis of Assisi, who I think was a real theater kid, to be honest, decided to bring a donkey and actors into Midnight Mass one year and play out the nativity scene. That was a performance, not a commodity. Now, at Christmas, we are surrounded by an embarrassment of commodities that attempt to signify a kind of joy and generosity at the heart of human life. But in reality, the spectacle they generate through countless dancing lights conceals as much as it reveals, if not more. Santa manifests gifts, but where do they come from? From a fantastical workshop, meaning from thin air. It's like Santa is the patron saint of children, but also the patron saint of the commodity fetish, which reaches its peak splendor to the extent that you forget how things are made and by whom, and you begin calling a certain brand of tree lights traditional and have no idea whether the factory they were made in is unionized or not. And even though you are a leftist, it is hard to even think about because what you're wanting, like everyone else, is the relief of a known spectacular and sensuous comfort. But what I've learned from Marx so far, and I did some recent episodes on Conspirituality podcast about this, is that in its periodic overflows of commodities that become detached from their makers and where the conditions of their manufacture are forgotten or covered over by their price tags, capitalism is a form of idolatry. Back in the old religions, there was always these arguments about whether God should be represented or not, because if you did try to do that, you would probably obscure the full unspeakable glory of divinity. Marx argued that the representations of value on the commodity market are godlike themselves, with money right at the tippy top, and that if we were mesmerized by this,
It's not that we'll miss the unspeakable glory of things, but we'll miss the unspeakable amount of human labor and love that poured out into them. We just won't see it. We won't see each other through the things that we offer each other. For me, it boils down to, what is the actual feeling of tradition or eternal return that I crave? And if those first sprigs of fake holly showing up at the Dollarama cue that feeling for me, will I remember what's actually happening? How I'm being deceived in a way? That the shelves are not actually filling up with Christmas, but with the time and lifeblood of working people who are just like me. My mother wasn't trying to trick me or pull a fast one with the old-timey ornaments and the fruitcake and the Springerly cookies. In her life, she was always reaching for something real, to recreate things from a time before box stores, a time of more simply accessible happiness, a time in which you could gather windfall from the olive grove and carve it by the light of an oil lamp into the shape of a lamb. Now, I could try to reconstruct my mom's fruitcake recipe, but I'm pretty sure I will never taste fruitcake like hers again. And that elicits a lot of feelings. In the capitalist mode of feeling, I think the emphasis is on regret. Something has been lost because the thing is no longer with you. But Marx also said, quote, "When the use value has been consumed, the labor embodied in it has also been extinguished." The fruitcake could have been anything. Ultimately, it was the work of my mother's hands. She made it for herself and her friends and for me. We ate it, and my mom's labor became my body, and that's why I'm here. So I'll keep putting the decorations up. I'll keep watering the tree. I'll keep humming along with the carols and having random verses pop into my head. I'll keep looking for those incandescent bulbs. But the beauty of their glow when they light up will come from remembering where those bulbs come from, how much life they contain, and how many darkest nights of the year it will take to build a kinder world. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care of each other.